Just a moment ago, I had a very painful muscle spasm in my foot. And the first thought was, I hope that goes away before the talk, yeah? And then second thought was, maybe this is a teachable moment. And I'm just going to narrate the foot spasm. And I thought, that's a good idea, maybe. Maybe a little self-absorbed. But and then I committed to it. And then the pain went away. This Dharma path, it generally revolves around what's to be released, not what's to be picked up. And from this perspective, suffering is our only problem ever. And to dispel suffering does not leave a vacuum in its place, but just goodness. Yeah, there's no goodness that needs to be manufactured in the absence of suffering. And so there's a lot of attention, of course, given to this. This is the path, in a sense, revolves around deconstructing suffering. And as teachers, in a certain way, I often feel like we're sort of almost like a nurse or a doctor, like palpating the body. We're sort of palpating the spiritual body to like actually sense where the clinging is, where suffering lies. And I think that makes a lot of sense, you know, for the most part. But it means that we talk about suffering a lot. So I was on the phone with a friend, and so he's a fellow meditation teacher, and kind of the best way to describe him is he's sort of living in a Dharma talk, meaning the way that he is approaching his life is just this like one huge investigation, kind of. And he's not kind of showing off about it, but if I call him up and say hello, he'll just basically start describing the Dharma exploration that's happening that day. And he's always deeply persuasive. So I'll get off the phone with him and feel like, I think I've been doing my life wrong, you know, like, you know. And one call, you know, he's just like, let me tell you what I'm looking at, Matthew. Like this. And he like launches into this whole thing, and he like makes this like case, you know, we're always asking people to open to suffering, to you know, to release, to soften the heart, and it's too much pleasure, that's where it's at, you know. And this is what we need to counterbalance the, and I actually alluded to this, the sense of protection, and it is true. It's like we do emphasize the themes of opening, relaxing into, being softened by life, because that often doesn't come so naturally to us, and we actually need encouragement and confidence that it's safe to do and it's valuable to do. But if we're trying to open from a mind that feels brittle or taxed, you know, overtaxed, we don't wind up opening to what's happening. We wind up marinating in what's happening, and that's that difference can be subtle, but it's important. And so this afternoon, I wanted to say something about kind of like Max talked a bit about the hindrances, and this is sort of like the anti-hindrances, the seven factors of awakening. And these seven factors, in a sense, they are both the path and the fruit of the practice. They are a practice in themselves, and they are the kind of fruit of our efforts, of our investigation. And so there's sometimes divided into energizing and tranquilizing factors with mindfulness at the center point. So mindfulness, investigation, effort, energy, and then rapture or delight and tranquility and samadhi, concentration and equanimity. And Sayadaw Tejaniya said the first three, mindfulness, investigation, energy, these are causes. The last four are effects. Yeah. The first three are things we do, energy we invest, and then delight and tranquility, samadhi, equanimity, these are actually the effects of the first three. These apparently were quite dear to the Buddha. One story in the suttas where he's sick at night and almost as if like to be soothed, as if a child being soothed by a bedtime story, says like to one of his disciples, like, please, you know, speak of the seven factors of awakening to me in this time of sickness here. Yeah. And so I'll say something about this unfolding, which can be, you know, is posited as a kind of a causal process, an ordered process, but I think all of the factors support each other. And sometimes, you know, when there's really not much suffering at all, sometimes the instruction is, okay, there's no suffering exactly to uproot, but just check into the mind to see how the relative balance of these seven factors. And sometimes we can be a little, like, we can be deeply content, but we're a little bit on the active side, the energizing, activating side, or we're a little on the tranquilized side. And sometimes that's fine, and sometimes then we just look like, okay, any very subtle way to balance the factors. So mindfulness, which In some ways, we begin the path by defining that, and in other ways, to understand mindfulness is the culmination of the path. Yeah. Like the facets and nuances of mindfulness, we can get seduced into thinking like, oh yeah, I know what it is, I'm just going to do it, right? But in a way, we come to understand over time more and more with each sit or each retreat, there's like a new appreciation of what this is, how radical its potential actually is. And so Gil Fronsdal said, if you're practicing meditation, you're learning meditation. If you're practicing it, you're learning it. Meaning it's not like we just figure out the technique and then just do that for the rest of our life. It's actually that to practice meditation, we're learning it. We're learning what mindfulness is as we practice. We're learning, in a sense, we have to learn each time we let go. We have to learn what that is. What does it mean to actually let go, to allow this into my heart right now? And so teachers sometimes say, you know, you hear this phrase like awareness of awareness. But the truth is mindfulness is actually always awareness of awareness. To be just aware is to be identified in the same way that a dog might be aware. To be just aware is to be identified with the contents of experience. And that is delusion. And so mindfulness is this movement to like a meta awareness, M-E-T-A. We're aware that we're having experience, to know our life as experience. Like right now. All of it mediated by mind. Nothing being known without that, you know. All experience is led by mind, made by mind. So we start to appreciate our life not merely for people, places, things, time, but just as experience, as a relentless flow of experience that can be known. This is what is said to be a kind of like guardian of the mind, that mindfulness is actually what keeps the inner life feeling safe. And we start to appreciate this too, because when mindfulness is there, even if there's some measure of suffering, there's something else that's always also true. Something else. When there's awareness, there's something else that's always also true. And so it creates some sense of of experience being more and more safe. And when experience starts to feel, when we're less intimidated by our inner life, the mind opens in important ways. Now, Max highlighted an important piece around this. That sense of being the moment rather than observing the moment. we start to get more and more intimate with experience, and it comes to feel like, the awareness is living in the experience of body or mind. And that sense of the perspective that like views from that is outside the flow of experience, and that kind of sense of duality that starts to soften, and we start to know experience in a deeper way. Usually the way in the scientific literature, at least, the way mindfulness is discussed is composing two factors. One is just this present moment awareness, an awareness that is clear and steady and alert, knowing experience as experience, knowing experience as experience. And then this second factor of equanimity, which is the culmination of the seven factors. Yeah. But I want to talk about it actually here paired with mindfulness, because they really work together. They really work together. So this equanimity, Sharon Salzberg says, even in one day or one hour, we can experience so many extremes of pleasure and pain. The question is, how can a human heart, my heart or your heart, absorb the continual, unremitting contrasts of this life without feeling shattered and thinking we cannot bear it? Battered by the changes, the heart-mind can become brittle, rigid. So, when there's just a sense of present time awareness without this kind of complementary dimension of equanimity, we're noticing, but the quality of the noticing is often infused with craving or aversion. Yeah. So we may not notice it, but it's like the quality of the attention has been captured by the defilements, by the forces of clinging. And so we're noticing, but we're creating, there's a lot of friction that's being generated. And the majesty of mindfulness is known when we start to distill out those strands of greed and aversion in the looking itself. Yeah. And so we can look in a way like hungry for something, hungry for pleasure or concentration or insight, right? Like sometimes I know I'll do a kind of look around the field of experience, and I'm just like looking for the Buddhist gold mine, kind of, you know, of just like where what's got to be insight somewhere in here in this shit storm, like somewhere it's there, yeah, right? It's like where, yeah. And hunger. It looks dignified, yeah. It looks like dignified clinging, yeah. But this factor of equanimity, of totally permitting the arising and intensification and thinning out and vanishing of experience. Like, we're so often in this mode of like manufacturing, of getting under the hood of experience, of doing our practice. And we're really just trying, like, here, it's not that we're trying to change experience, but are willing to be changed by it. You can feel how different that orientation is. Like, I'm willing this pain or delight or heartache or whatever, I'm willing to be changed by it. I will not insist on being the person I was a moment ago. I'm just willing to be changed by it. And in that kind of deep permission for the life to be what it is, we're like moment by moment making peace with the imperfection of the human condition. And this means that we're practicing softening the body, relaxing the mind, relaxing judgment, knowing that part of this practice is about not squandering pain. No. Like, that's at some level that is the commitment, to know that there is redemption in it, in knowing it, being willing to be changed by it. And hopefully we sort of are asked to absorb bearable doses. Yeah. Sometimes we get too big a dose, and we have to back off, we have to find another way of practicing, we have to lie down and you know take a rest, take a nap, take a long walk, something. We reestablish some balance, and then there's again energy, like there's some energy, I'm willing to be changed by this. And to do this, To open to imperfection is a kind of, this is how we learn to love more deeply, more radically, in that kind of when the kind of challenge meets this clear, equanimous heart, something gets softened. You can feel it. It's like the classical language is purification. Something. It's like consciousness is being aerated in some way. And so that line from Leonard Cohen, even though it all went wrong, I'll stand before the Lord of Song with nothing on my tongue but hallelujah. Yeah. Like, to actually be so open that there's almost, there is gratitude for the complexities of our life. In doing this work, some of what we must do is tolerate ambivalence. And maybe ambivalence is like another version of the First Noble Truth, yeah. So this is an advice columnist who is not a Buddhist, to my knowledge, but seems to have stumbled upon some of the Buddhist wisdom somehow, and Heather Haverleski. And she's giving, like, marital advice to somebody, and And she somehow captures something that feels important here. So she's giving some advice, and then she's describing her own mind and how she relates to kind of ambivalence and opening to that. So she's writing, she says, my husband is a pretty good cook, but I always know better than him about everything. Sometimes he doesn't clean the counter to my specifications after chopping up a mess, just for example. I consider his cooking slow and inefficient, and merely watching him move around the kitchen makes me feel impatient. I grew up watching my mother, who's an amazingly good cook, skilled and relaxed and intuitive, with great taste. So even though these days my husband's meals are often better than mine, if I watch him cook, I get picky and pushy and judgmental. So when my husband's cooking, I don't go into the kitchen at all. I know myself. But if you ask me to go in there and observe and then write down my thoughts, I would craft a masterful case against my husband's competence as a person. I would start with the mess, and then I would use that bad choice as an organizing principle and apply it to everything stupid about him. I do this not because I hate him. I would do this because, A, I have a lot of opinions and feelings, and B, I'm a wound-up person with laser focus, and C, I actually enjoy making cases for and against people, places, and things, and D, I live in a house with another adult human who is not me. This adult human does not sound or smell like me, and he doesn't do things the way I do them. Therefore, I sometimes hate him. I also love him. She goes on, yeah? So, like, that kind of wish to, like, root out all ambivalence, yeah? And I think of it as a kind of measure of equanimity, of like just tolerating the loose ends of being human. Yeah. So supported by mindfulness, there is this Dhammavicaya investigation, and really, you know, we could say that curiosity is the lifeblood of this practice. It's fueled, you know, by curiosity. And in a way, it's the maybe the most trustworthy intention, because curiosity has no agenda but to see, and that makes it very conducive to growth. And teachers, we can kind of like prod and make suggestions and nudge in certain ways, like to try to spark interest, but it's very personal. Like when we actually get, the mind gets turned on by like something of, I want to see what is happening here. And we sort of stop caring so much about how we feel or how we're doing or what's going on or what we're going to get. Or it's just like this, like, just real, deep, totally personal wish. Like, I want to see where this goes. The Buddha said that when in pain, we have four options. Blame oneself, blame others, despair, or investigate. Yeah. You know, it's D, The answer is D. Right? Like, sometimes the mind so doesn't want that. It's just like, just want to rearrange the conditions of our life in that moment. But it's like, okay, is there anything here that's like, anything in me that's actually interested? Yeah. A friend of mine said, she's a serious meditator, and she's like, she's kind of questioning how meditation and Dharma is taught. And she was just like, you know, when I went to college, like, we would get quizzed. Like, the professor would just, like, call on us and say, like, hey, you know, what's the answer to da, 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 right? And she's like, why? Meditation teachers, they never do that. It's all this passive kind of just dumping some data, and then we just listen. And she's like, no, we, I'm not going to do this, by the way, just like, but like, she's like, no, we need to like mix it up more. Like, we need to like shake up the teaching methods in a way to make it more engaged. And I like, I have something like, whoa, that's interesting. Yeah. And what she's really asking for is a kind of ways of sparking the curiosity in us and kind of engaging with the material in a deeply personal way, which hopefully we can do. Yeah, like that is the opportunity of retreat. And there's so much concern about like how I'm doing, or sort of benchmarking practice in one way or another. Such a human tendency to do that. But no matter what is happening, no matter how you think you're doing, there are opportunities for learning, for investigation. I was in an interview. I was sitting a retreat with Michelle McDonald, and she kind of you know, going back and forth for a while, and she's sort of like doing that thing that I actually was mentioning of like palpating the body, you know, like kind of looking for zones of suffering in me. Yeah. And she like, it was a sense of like, well, she's kind of probing and not really finding anything. Yeah. And then she said to me, she said, you're very subtle and incredibly well defended. Yeah. What? Yeah. What does that mean, Michelle? In the moment, it was just actually total delight. Yeah, honestly. Because I trust her. I trust her mind. And it was like, whoa. Like, you know that those moments where there's like a whole new vista, like, and all of a sudden, like, the narrative you've been telling about yourself is just called into question. Yeah. And it's like, who am I? What am I? Yeah. Those are disorienting moments, but beautiful. Yeah. We can have those moments on retreat each day. This investigation is not not rumination. It's not like we're trying to do long division in our head, yeah? And then we get the answer. It's much more like we're listening deeply to ourselves without an agenda actually to put the puzzle pieces together, but we're just listening deeply. And when we have kind of gathered enough data, when we've heard enough through the continuity of our mindfulness, insight arises. And it has the character of those like optical illusion things where it's profiles of two faces or it's a vase or something. And insight is like, we only saw the faces, and now there's a vase, yeah? Something happens. But it comes out of that process of this very quiet, gentle listening. Yeah. And when this starts to build momentum, the energy just follows. Yeah. It's like we just want to see, and there's an urgency in the seeing. The awareness starts to matter more than our life. Yeah. More than our preferences, more than our progress or status, more than what anyone thinks about us. And so we can't fake interest or curiosity, but when there's an opening, we follow it, yeah. And we follow it with some energy. Energy, effort is among the most kind of emphasized themes in retreat. And I think this is so because in some ways neurosis is the path of least resistance. Yeah. Like that's where gravity pulls us, yeah. At least in some aspects of our heart mind, it's like it's gonna take energy. Yeah. And the kind of deep growth that the Buddha prescribes does call on our courage, our effort, our energy. And at the experiential level, the way at least I've experienced a lot of this, the way I've experienced that the kind of way we were being called to grow in these uncomfortable ways that it takes energy to do. And we can look like the actual process of developing insight, of letting go, of nourishing compassion. The way that process actually feels at ground level in our experience often is, for me at least, something a little bit akin to grieving. We're not necessarily letting go of someone or something. But the way we experience growth and this process of the heart expanding, the bandwidth of our own heart expanding, the way that feels in the trenches is sometimes a little bit like grieving. Yeah. And so if that's coming up, yeah, it feels like something's being lost, something's being pulled from our grasp. That's a facet of practice, or not doing it wrong. And this takes energy, Energy is often, we often think about it as these kind of intense bursts, but it's often described more as kind of persistence, persevering, staying with experience, can keep going. This is Sayadaw Tejaniya. Right effort is effort with wisdom, because where there's wisdom, there's interest. The desire to know something is wisdom at work. Being mindful is not difficult, but it's difficult to be continuously aware. For that, you need right effort. But it does not require a great deal of energy. It's a relaxed perseverance in reminding yourself to be aware. When you're aware, wisdom unfolds naturally, and there's still more interest. The meaning of effort is to try to continue, to try to be patient, to try to be relaxed. Try to continue to be patient, to be relaxed. That's the effort. Maybe it comes in a moment or in waves, but this gives way to a certain kind of delight in coming home to experience. There's a sense of homecoming when we start to actually know our life in this way. And usually when we talk about piti or rapture, delight, joy, it's a kind of intense, effervescent, the body gripped by delight. But there's more subtle aspects of it, and sometimes it's just like something, even if it's difficult, something in the heart is on fire about practice. Yeah. Gil said something like, I'm just so happy to have a path. I don't even care how I'm doing, yeah. It's like when you really actually know that there's a path here, there's a kind of progressive unfolding, there's a path with heart. Very reassuring, very reassuring. Because we start to develop a kind of confidence that all of life is practicable. All of life can be transmuted into, can be known as Dharma, transmuted into understanding and love. That's not something we can take another person's word for, but it's something we can come to know. And so we start to, when we're satisfied, when something in the heart is satisfied, there's less hunger for stimulation. Yeah. That kind of way the mind goes foraging, and we like subsist on thoughts. Yeah. That's the best we can do in some moments. It's like the mind's hungry and we'll just give it the past or future. Yeah. But when there's satisfaction, something's satiated. There's no hunger. And so we move into tranquility, and the whole like nervous system, the dial is just turned way down. Something in us, like the heart longs to be unstimulated by the vicissitudes of experience. And that doesn't mean like a cold heart. It's a heart that is ready to manifest with love or compassion at the drop of a hat. But something really like in some ways we're playing this game with stimulation to try to find the perfect balance to be at homeostasis, at the heart's like deepest longing is just to be peace. It's the only thing that doesn't fatigue the heart. And so there's a sense of that nothing needs to happen. To even know that for a moment is a gift to like nothing needs to happen. Sense of the energy always tumbling forward, the energy of becoming. But in tranquility, it's like just this, just what is given in this moment is enough. This moment is not being leveraged for anything, and just to rest is enough. And in such a state, we can't but help for the attention to be gathered together, to start to be unified, collected, the mind collected. And this collectedness of mind, it's like, so much of the change, of course, is still happening, but there's so much less static that we can listen more and more deeply to our own mind and heart. Yeah, the quality of listening is really deepened, it's stabilized. And this turns the path into what was a kind of sort of a little bit philosophical, that way in which you kind of relate to some teachings and they're not fully embodied. They just remain a little bit in the realm of ideas, and maybe we're compelled by them, but they feel a little thin. Yeah. And it's samadhi that transforms the Dharma from like mere philosophy into a path, and it brings a kind of confidence. At a meeting this morning where somebody said, like, just reflecting on kind of moments of stillness and understanding of settledness, it was like, oh, I know I can do this. Yeah, that's what they said. And so it actually, we start to see, appreciate the capacity of our own mind that maybe we exempted as like the case, the one person the Buddha wasn't talking about which is kind of how we all feel about ourselves, you know? Like, just at least a part of the mind is like, yeah, I know you're talking about like all of them, but not this, you know, right? This, really? Really? I might be free. So we're learning in this realm to abandon hope in working through our life with thinking. And because our thinking is so useful, so powerful, so helpful, in a certain way, we feel like it's the only thing that solves problems. Yeah. It's like there's a problem. It could be as simple as a pain in the knee or some big thing going on in our lives. And it feels like thinking is how to solve it. And even just being in the realm of thought, being identified with thought, to be identified with thought, thought has a kind of, a certain kind of urgency, or like, it just feels, it can feel like every thought that we're really, truly identified with, truly lost in, feels important. Yeah. It's like we get kind of seduced by it over and over, and there's almost like this gravitational pull of thinking. And so we perceive any kind of threat or opportunity, and the mind just like tries to figure out how to navigate or capitalize on it. But we don't think our way to freedom. And even our Dharma stories are ultimately unsatisfying. So we start to sense in like this this need to compulsively narrate our lives. We actually start to investigate and maybe can see that it's so innocent, the kind of compulsive thinking. It's like we're trying to keep track of what can hurt or help us. And we're doing it moment by moment. And that very innocent impulse, in a sense, to control experience keeps us working in the realm of thought. And so we can actually sense into the way in which there is actually a kind of almost a terror of not talking to ourselves. Yeah. Like we're just having experience, and we're like moment by moment updating the autobiography, yeah, to include everything that's just happened, and part of why we take the precepts, part of why we commit like wholeheartedly to non-harming, to goodwill, to sangha, is so that maybe something in our body gets the sense like it's safe enough, maybe, to settle into the quiet, to the dark, wondrous, bottomless present. Max talked about the verticality. Without thought, the moment is bottomless. And then we know ourselves both as a character in narrative, which is important. Yeah. Part of Dharma is maturing our autobiography. But we also know ourselves as a kind of, the way one of my teachers, Shinzen Young, put it, like a sensory system. We know our life as experience. Not preferencing thinking over the rest. Yeah. So mindfulness, investigation, energy, delight, tranquility, samadhi, and then looping back to equanimity, something like total connection, total porousness, total safety in one's mind, made safe by the openness of the heart. I offer that for your consideration, and pick up whatever is useful, and leave behind whatever is not. Yeah. Sit for a moment. Thank you.